Well, the next case is called, we have a court reporter in the next case, is that correct? Come on up. Let me suggest something to you. I've been in this courtroom a lot, and I don't think you have. That's a long ways away. Why don't you move over here? Set up over there, because your job will be a whole lot easier if you do that. Right here in the well of the court. Right here. Got a chair for you? Sure. All right. You can get even closer if you want. It's up to you. I'm just trying to help you. All right. Clerk will call the next case.
Use individually and others versus Henry individually and others. William A. Turd, Stephen C. Heathcraft, Ryan J. Strasser, John H. Craddock, Jr., Michelle Burkhardt, and Appellant's Counsel. Craig T. Merritt, S. Gary Coburn, Gordon M. Phillips, Robert E. Scully, Jr., Thomas M. Buchanan, John W. H. Harding, Michael P. DeGrandis, John O. Easton, Carol T. Stone, Appellant's Counsel.
Mr. Hurd, you may proceed. I assume that you are making the argument. Let me, for the sake of everybody's understanding, you're going to take all 15 minutes of your side.
I am not. I'm sorry. Right. 3 minutes for a while.
All right. Now, the other side involves more than one party arguing, and they're going to split their time, and that will be noted on the clock. All right? All right. You may proceed, Mr. Hurd.
May it please the court, I'm William Hurd, representing Becky Williams both individually and cryptically. The ethical rules that govern attorney conduct are critical to the integrity of our profession and to public confidence in our profession. One of those rules is 1.8a. This governs an attorney's business dealings with his clients, and which, among other things, requires those contracts to be fair and reasonable. Bruce Henry violated that rule.
Let me ask you this, because the bar looked at this, and according to the papers, at the intake stage, kicked it out. What impact would that play on our, because they're ultimately responsible, subject to our review of the enforcement of a discipline?
Well, none. Okay. Would have no effect, and that was not pled below. There was no suggestion below of any kind of preclusive effect. Whatever it was, it wasn't necessarily the full vote here that was alleged in that proceeding. Bruce Henry violated the rule with the forfeiture provision and perpetual control provision. Those are not fair and reasonable. And the most striking thing, perhaps, about his brief is he makes no attempt to say they were fair and reasonable. Instead, he says, in effect, that there's nothing this court can do about it. But if ethical rules are to mean anything, surely he must be wrong about that.
Well, they obviously do mean quite a lot, and their ethical rules can be enforced, and the public policy behind them can be advanced in disciplinary proceedings wholly unrelated to undoing an arbitration award. So it's not as if the rule is being set aside as irrelevant or dispensed with. That's a bit of an overstatement.
Well, he says nothing can be done about it here in this court. He says it cannot be used, the rules cannot be used as a shield to prevent the enforcement of a contract that violates the rule. But this court has never said that, and he cites no cases.
But what provision of 8.01, 581.010 does your argument fit into?
It fits into an arbitrator cannot exceed his or her authority. Our argument is that this contract violates Rule 1.8.
Perhaps one of the broadest standards of review there is, as far as I can tell.
It is a violation of public policy. And the question is then, does the requirement that an arbitrator not exceed his or her authority nevertheless allow them to enforce contracts that violate public policy? This court has never said that. Let's go back to the roots, if I may, to common law. The common law says that contracts that violate public policy are not to be enforced. And this court has said repeatedly that the common law must be read into any statute that touches upon the matter, unless the statute overrules the common law, either expressly or by necessary implication. There's nothing in the Arbitration Act that overrules the common law principles at work here. So the common law remains intact, and arbitrators have no authority to enforce a contract that violates public policy.
What about the statutory provision that says that arbitrators can award relief that would not otherwise be available in the common law courts or the courts of equity?
Well, there is, of course, a category of relief that would not be otherwise available in court equity, but that would not go so far as to violate public policy, which is the problem we have here. You know, there are not a lot of contracts that violate public policy, but those that do are, by definition, matters of deep concern. Violation of ethical rules, racially restrictive covenants, firing an employee who becomes pregnant, enforcing a lifetime non-compete, we cite these in our brief, perhaps a few others. This court would not allow Virginia courts to unravel public policy by enforcing such contracts directly.
Well, let me ask you a question, if I can. I understand that you argue public policy as a major issue in your case. Let me drill down just a little bit and tell me if I'm correct. The two aspects of public policy that you focus on is that the agreement or the disclosure was not signed in accordance with the rule. That's one. Is that right?
Yes.
And the second is that the actual agreement itself on its face and as it has operated is fundamentally unfair.
It's not fair and reasonable, correct.
All right, so is there anything other than that that comprises, I just want to focus on what it is. Is that it?
There are two parts of
the second.
Wonderful and a first prong. One is it's not fair and reasonable,
right.
And the other is that it was not adequately disclosed. If you look at the disclosure letter that Bruce Henry and his colleagues sent to explain what was going on, it deviated materially from the actual operating agreement.
Okay, well, that's what I'm getting. Then there's three things.
Yes.
There's the failure to sign, which is one of the issues.
Correct.
Failure to disclose, even though they're irrespective of the signature. And then a fundamental unfairness in the control and the expulsion clauses of the agreement. Am I right? I just want to know. Am I right?
That's correct. No.
Okay, go ahead.
So if this court would not allow other Virginia courts to enforce directly contracts that violate public policy, this court should not allow Virginia courts to do so indirectly by confirming arbitration awards that violate those same public policies. In a nutshell,
I don't know how much I quibble with your premise, but like an illegal contract, I get on the dark web and I order a pound of cocaine, and there's an arbitration clause in there. I don't see how a Virginia court can enforce that contract. My question is, this is a little more nuanced, though, than your typical situation where an attorney with more knowledge and bargaining power is extorting something out of an unsophisticated person. So you have a fairly sophisticated client who's a successful real estate developer who's independently advised by a very able, very experienced lawyer, and the evidence is he signs off on it, and he gets this guarantee of a not insubstantial amount that rescues from foreclosure and appears this commercial real estate. So, I wonder to what extent this specific scenario does violate public policy.
Well, I would say the following with respect to that. Number one, the gentleman was very old.
Well, 71, right?
Number two, I would say that
be careful.
But we cannot inquire into the particulars of
but how can we not? Because you're saying fair and reasonable is one of the ways this flunks public policy. So
So you look at the terms. Look at the terms. And yes, there was a guarantee, but the control that Bruce Henry took was lasted well past that guarantee. It was not in order to protect him as he was the guarantor.
But one question I had there is, was this Mr. Henry driving the forfeiture provision, or was it Mr. Bogle, you know, concerned about, and we see this all the time, the family strife, families being torn apart, and lawyers enriching themselves, impoverishing the family estate. So I just wondered about that point.
Well, so I would say that this forfeiture provision kicks in even if everybody is opposed to Bruce Henry, which undercuts that argument.
Okay.
Number two, it kicks in even if he has been guilty of appropriating funds and that is proven. It kicks in. The only thing it doesn't kick in on is if all you do is try to remove him. Now, another point that's important here is who has the burden of proof on all this? Well, Bruce Henry has the burden of proof to show that it is fair and reasonable. I don't think there's any evidence from him on that score in this record. There is the report of Leslie Haley, who said there's no indication that the terms of the transaction were fair and reasonable. It is, after all, their motion to expel. The rule is written so that a contract between an attorney and his client, business contract, is prohibited unless certain conditions are met. In the Stias case, we cite Anna Breed, she says the attorney has the burden to show the contract with the client is fair and reasonable. Now, the arbitrators never addressed that. They never said this contract is fair and reasonable.
But one of the biggest reasons for arbitration is that it doesn't get relitigated in the courts. That's the reason commercial parties and non-commercial parties go to arbitration.
Justice Kelsey, and that is true. And that should foreclose like cases like 99% of the time.
Okay.
Perhaps even more. But if
it wouldn't foreclose a contract for a cocaine purchase on the dark web. It wouldn't foreclose a racially discriminatory violation of Shelley versus Kramer. It wouldn't foreclose a bigamous marriage. You're nowhere near that here.
It's all public policy, Your Honor. This
well, so
this
is the law generally. Everything in the code book is public policy.
Not in the sense of being a contract that violates public policy. And this is that. And because it is that, it is ultimately an issue for the courts to decide. Is this contract in violation of public policy or not?
Counsel, and I know you addressed it in your brief, but I didn't quite understand it there either. Austin Power addresses an argument of public policy, a violation of public policy. And it appears to me that the bottom line was that we decided that the court decides only whether the arbitrators had the power to decide contract claims. So obviously there are gradations of public policy where this court will say that is not a public policy that we're going to allow to overcome an arbitration agreement.
Your Honor, I don't think this court has ever said that some contracts that violate public policy are okay and enforceable and others are not.
But
it is the definition. What it means to violate public policy is that the contract is not enforceable. And in the Alston case, the court said that an arbitration decision that awarded liquidated damages could not be vacated on public policy grounds. Well, there is no public policy against awarding liquidated damages. So, of course, there was no public policy grounds to bail. But I think that it is very, very dangerous for the court to say it is all right for arbitrators to enforce contracts that violate public policy. And this one certainly does. I see my time is running out.
May I ask one question, Chief?
Sure.
Is the better argument that the ethical violation should be left to the bar, to police, and any violation of the contract itself left to the arbitration?
Your Honor, no for these reasons. Number one, if a bar complaint was brought, the first thing we would do is wave around the arbitration opinion and say it's already been decided. Number two, the bar cannot restore Jackie Views to her position in Alexandria Investments. That's what needs to be done here.
The preamble to the professional rules of professional responsibility tend to indicate that the rules are not designed as a basis for civil liability. Does that detract from your argument?
It does not, because that talks about using it as a sword, not a shield. There are a number of rules in 1.8, this A, this H, or some others, that talk about the limitations on an attorney's ability to contract with his clients. There's, for example, the prohibition against contingency contracts in a criminal case. Well, is the court going to enforce those unethical contracts on the theory that the rules cannot be used as a shield? The Hansman case already suggests that an overreaching attorney-client contract in the fee context will not be enforced. And in the Roller case, cited early in the last century, the court said it would not enforce attorney-client contracts that violate public policy. So I think it is a short step forward for this court to say that a contract in violation of 1.8a is not enforceable. It is a big step backwards to say that they are enforceable. And if those contracts are not enforceable as a matter of common law, then the arbitrators exceed their authority when they enforce contracts the common law says may not be enforced. And the circuit court exceeds its authority when it enforces indirectly a contract against public policy it could not enforce directly.
May it please the court, my name is Craig Merritt. I'm here on behalf of all appellees. We have reserved 3 minutes of our time for Mr. Buchanan to address the issue of sanctions against Ms. Fife, which is an independent issue.
Okay, the clock has been set to your 12, so it's not 3 minutes after you get, it's when that's zero, you're through.
Yes, sir.
All right, go ahead.
Subject to any questions the court may have, I have 3 points I'd like to address. The first is governing law. The second is the grounds that are being pitched to you to walk away from controlling law. And the third is the fundamental fairness of these procedures, particularly with regard to the discovery issues that have been raised. First, controlling law. There's already been reference to the BBF versus Alston case, this court's decision in 2007. There's a concise summary of where this court stands on the scope of the review statute at page 330 and 331 of that case, where Justice Stevenson goes back and reviews the bidding and talks about the 2003 decisions in Signal and in Wackman. In Signal, for a unanimous court, Justice Hassell rejected an effort to work around the review statute under the guise of imposing a manifest disregard of the law standard. And in doing so, made this point. I'm at 265 Virginia at 46. Conspicuously missing from this statute is a provision that permits a court to vacate a judicial award when the arbitration panel has exhibited a manifest disregard of the law. In this commonwealth, courts are required to apply the plain meaning of statutes, and we are not free to add language nor to ignore language contained in statutes. The BBF opinion then turns to a review of Wackman, and in Wackman, again for a unanimous court, Justice Lacy rejected an end-around effort, this time relying on the equitable powers of courts to evade the scope of the review statute and the arbitration act.
So what about this parade of horribles, you know, the contingency contract in the criminal case, or even the person who goes on the dark web and gets his pound of cocaine, hey, there's an arbitration clause in their Russian arbitrator panel said, go ahead, you ship the cocaine. There has to be a line somewhere.
There is a line somewhere.
So help us with that.
Well, as someone has already pointed out, we are nowhere close to it here.
Okay.
And part of the reason, and I'll just go directly to the second point, because this is a fundamental misconception in the argument that's being presented. The argument about public policy in this case is a straw man. It is a straw man because the record shows that the panel took steps to avoid conflict between the disciplinary objectives of this court's rules and the civil dispute that was before it. We've already heard reference to the well-known language in this court's rules of professional conduct in the preamble, where this court makes it crystal clear that violations of rules neither give rise to causes of action, nor do they create any presumption that a legal duty has been breached. According to this court, quote, accordingly, nothing in the rules should be deemed to augment any substantive legal duty of lawyers or the extradisciplinary consequences of violating such a duty. This panel understood that. If you look in the joint appendix, in the findings and the conclusions, at page 9, footnote 9, dealing with this issue, this attempt to insert Rule 1.8 into a fundamentally civil dispute, the panel says, Muse also contends that Henry's failure to obtain Jack's written consent voids the transaction. While no one has produced a signed copy of Jack's consent, it is clear from Zaccardelli's testimony and other evidence that Jack gave informed consent and, at a minimum, signed a long series of transactional documents further evidencing that consent.
Counsel, does the rule require informed consent or written consent? The rule requires written consent.
It requires written consent, and the court is saying you've got any number of writings that were signed. It doesn't say how the consent has to be given. But the important point is in the next sentence. In any event, Rule 1.8 is a rule of ethics, not a rule defining liabilities. The absence of Jack's signature by itself is no basis for invalidating the transaction 13 years after the fact. This panel understood that there is a boundary. On one side of the boundary is the application of ethical rules like Rule 1.8 under the auspices of this court through the Virginia State Bar. In a civil dispute like we had here, the attack on the Alexandria Investments Operating Agreement was determined under rules of unconscionability. Many of the facts and factors, by the way, that would be considered under Rule 1.8 in a disciplinary setting were relevant under the doctrine of unconscionability.
It seems that part of their argument is that a bar complaint cannot restore this litigant to participation in this corporation or this in this entity. Why isn't the argument that a bar complaint is an insufficient remedy a reason for us to consider the argument?
The question illustrates the point precisely. A bar complaint is not a basis for restoring anything to a litigant in this setting. A bar complaint is for the discipline of the attorney who is involved and the consequences for that attorney's licensing. I can tell you that early on in my career, I had a trial involving a lawyer who was out of trust. We tried it in Fairfax Circuit Court, but we did not use the rules of professional responsibility to set the standard. He was sued for conversion, for gross negligence, all the things that would have entitled my client, who happened to be a bank, to get the money back in a civil context. In a separate proceeding, applying those rules, the bar determined the fate of his law license. Conflating and confusing those two things is the basis, and that's why I tell you it's a straw man argument. You have to accept the fact that this arbitration panel purported to apply lawyer discipline in some way. They did not. That is not their turf. They knew it was not their turf. They said it was not their turf.
But isn't
they
it,
resolved a civil dispute under contract rules.
Isn't it even easier than that? That there's a boundary line between mere contractual defenses, like unconscionability, undue influence, etc., and public policy concepts, which are very few and far between, that void all contracts no matter what, big and mismarriage contracts, Shelley versus Kramer, racial discriminatory contracts. And surely those kinds of public policy overlays trump out everything, including the powers of the arbitrator. But we're just simply nowhere near that. We're in a simple contract dispute with a simple contract defense that was rejected by the decision maker.
Correct.
Let me ask you a question, if I might. People talk about public policy and as if that's something that's easier to identify in this case. Suppose the rule that we've been talking about says that all the disclosures have to be on green paper. I don't know why they do that, but suppose it said that. Well, surely the public policy wouldn't be extended to a dispute like this so that if it was on yellow paper, that somehow public policy would be violated. I think everybody would probably agree with that. Maybe I'm wrong. If that's the case, then let's penetrate what is it about this rule is public policy, if any. And Justice Kelsey's already suggested that he may very well take the position, I would never hold him to it, we go to a room and talk, that maybe there's no public policy in this. But assuming that there is public policy, what is it? Is it disclosure? Is fairness? Is that what it is? What is it?
As we understand the public policy being pitched by the appellant, it is the public policy that is served by Rule 1.8 to protect parties when they are in a financial transaction with their attorney by assuring that they understand and have transparency about the facts and circumstances and the risks that are presented. That's the public policy behind 1.8 and what the bar would be looking at in lawyer discipline. It presents itself in this case because the appellant claims that the operating agreement of an LLC has provisions in it that are overreaching and tries to tie them back to the lawyer's conflict or alleged conflict. The difficulty is that correctly in the complaint, claiming that that was unconscionable, the correct rubric under which to put that kind of a claim, the panel looked at and all the facts and circumstances and said there was nothing unconscionable about this. Query, in a case where Jack Bogle and the entities involved all hired separate counsel, Mr. Right. Henry wasn't even representing them, there's a threshold question as to whether the purpose of Rule 1.8A is even in play anymore. So it's this confusion is a real struggle.
Right, because the rule just doesn't address this situation where someone is represented by a separate lawyer and there's ample evidence, they carefully considered it and they sign off on it. I mean, it says nothing about that type of...
I would argue scenario. That that's correct. And we'll also note that we're now talking about the merits of a decision that arbitrators made. That's one of the dangers of this kind of a pitch, because it sends us down the pathway of guessing whether the arbitrators got the facts right and applied the law right to them. And we would suggest that is not within the scope of the powers under the statute that this court would have. Just one point on discovery before I sit. This is about process and whether there was substantial prejudice. All of these discovery rulings are laid out in painful detail in our brief at pages 16 through 18. Every opportunity was extended to get fair discovery related to the merits of this case. There is nowhere in the record where this panel found that it did not have the power to compel from the respondents anything it needed to get, and they gave everything that was requested. My time is up. We respectfully ask that the court affirm the decision below. Thank you.
May it please the court, Thomas Buchanan on behalf of appellee defendant Nancy Fife. Ms. Fife was awarded sanctions below by the tribunal in amount of about $900,000. Those are the fees and costs that our firm incurred in defending her. The panel found that Muse's actions against Fife were, quote, commenced without reasonable cause, unquote, under Section 13.1-105 of the Virginia Limited Liability Company Act. They further found that Muse's suit warranted sanctions because it was not, quote, well-grounded in fact, unquote, and it was brought for, quote, improper purposes of vindictiveness, harassment, and payback, unquote. Muniz does not challenge the reasonableness of the fees or the authority of the tribunal to award the fees. She merely argues that had she been given unfettered access to my client's emails and to her financial records, she somehow could have found a nugget of evidence that would support her one claim of the five claims regarding my clients receiving fees for guaranteeing loans. And that if she had this access through a subpoena to be issued by the tribunal, she could have defeated the sanctions motion. The problem with that, that's not the standard. The standard is, what evidence did Muse have at the commencement of litigation? Did she have well-grounded facts? Did she have a proper purpose to just cause? They never address that. They suggest to you that we should look out after discovery, after unfettered discovery, unprecedented discovery in an arbitration proceeding, and speculate that maybe she would have found something to support one of her claims. What she fails to also do is to address the major claim. The major claim is she sued my client, the other defendants, for $50 million for an extravagant, unprecedented fraud involving money laundering, embezzlement, and theft. That's never mentioned in any of her papers, not once. Never mentioned. She doesn't address the main claim because there's no evidence whatsoever of that claim. There were three other claims that the tribunal addresses in footnote 5 on page 5 of its opinion. Again, they don't address any of those claims in their arguments. They waive those claims at trial. They never appealed if there was any justification for those. There's just this one claim about whether my client was justified in getting fees for guaranteeing loans. There's no dispute that the guarantee was necessary, that they guaranteed it, and that the fees, the guarantee fees, were reasonable. Their whole argument is that somewhere out there, maybe, there's some evidence. Had they granted an open-ended subpoena going back 15 years to look at all my client's emails, maybe somewhere there would be something to support that one insignificant claim. And that is not the basis to vacate an award of attorney's fees and costs. Thank you.
Mr. Hurd.
Very quickly, opposing counsel is wrong about the panel did not think it had authority to order discovery beyond what was agreed to. Look, please, at the March 1st order found at JA 650 and 51, the March 21st reaffirming that order found at JA 827. Their position is that lawyers who enter into unethical contracts can still enforce them. It is an outrageous position, one I hope this court does not accept. And, Your Honor, that rule has three prongs. The second prong deals with where a lawyer has been involved. That is not sufficient. You still need prongs one and two, and Justice Powell, the evidence, testimony, the case law is signing the transactional documents is not good enough. If public policy is to favor arbitration, then arbitration in turn must favor public policy, including the policy set by this court for your lawyers and the public when it promulgated Rule 1A, which was violated here egregiously by Bruce Henry. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The court is going to have to do a little bit of musical chairs here before the clerk calls the next case, so just bear with us. Thank you very much for your arguments.